Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a free ebook for you to download today that you won't want to miss. It's called In Conversation with Jordan Peterson, Atheism, Christianity, and the Psychology of Belief. This special ebook was created from an unbelievable podcast with famed Canadian psychologist Jordan Peterson. And in it, you'll discover how to bring order to a chaotic world using the wisdom of the Bible. So download your free copy of In Conversation with Jordan Peterson by visiting premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. This is a limited time offer, so make sure to do it today. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Hello and welcome back to this week's Classic Replay. Justin here to introduce this week's show from the archive. Now, C.S. Lewis is a much beloved Christian writer and thinker from the 20th century. In fact, you can find a whole podcast from Premier dedicated to his life and work, the C.S. Lewis podcast with Alistair McGrath, hosted by my colleague Ruth Jackson. But on this show, from October 2010, C.S. Lewis scholar Michael Ward and atheist activist Dan Barker debated whether Lewis's Christian apologetics were convincing or not. And by the way, Michael Ward has a new book out on Lewis right now. It's called After Humanity, A Guide to C.S. Lewis's The Abolition of Man. You may be interested in getting hold of that as well. But for now, let's hear Michael Ward and Dan Barker debating. And don't forget, you can find many more shows from the Unbelievable podcast archive at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Well, gentlemen, thank you very much for joining me in the studio and on the line today. Perhaps we'll start with you, Michael, my studio guest today. You came on over a year ago now to talk about C.S. Lewis with a young lady who had written a book about her own experiences of Narnia and then growing somewhat disillusioned when she discovered there was this Christian imagery undergirding it. I'm going to post a link to that show, which was a really interesting discussion between the two of you. But today we're moving on from Narnia, which is perhaps what Lewis is best known popularly for, to his apologetics, which is perhaps the second thing that most Christians certainly know him for. When did you first bump into C.S. Lewis, the apologist, as it were?
Probably when I was about 12, 13. It must have been about then that I read his Mere Christianity, which I think is his best known work of Christian apologetics, and which was based on a series of radio broadcasts that he gave on the BBC during the Second World War.
I mean, what I would give to have C.S. Lewis in the studio with me. Unfortunately, he very inconsiderately isn't alive anymore at the time that I need him for my radio programme. You, however, I think, are the modern equivalent.
Oh, no. Please. No way.
I had a feeling you might dissociate yourself from that. But certainly, you've spent a lot of time thinking about C.S. Lewis. What is it about the man and the Christianity he embodied that has made it for you a subject of study for the whole of your academic career?
Well, I like him mostly as a writer. I think he's just a very skillful writer. But what appeals to me about his presentation of Christianity in particular is that it's both imaginative and rational. He's got two sides to him. A lot of people are imaginative and can write powerful stories and poems and plays, and they know how to use metaphors and imagery and images and things like that. But those sorts of people don't often have a highly trained, logical, disciplined, rational side. And Lewis did. He taught philosophy at Oxford before he became an English literature scholar. And you get both those things in his presentation of Christianity.
Do you think, possibly in the world of apologetics, we need more of that? Because there's a lot of, and you get it every week on this programme, kind of reasoned argument. I wonder, though, whether the imaginative flair that Lewis brought to his work is something that we sometimes miss. We don't have the ability to put it out in poetry, in film, in you know, generally read literature in the way that he somehow managed to do.
Yeah, well, if one is relying entirely on reason to talk about the faith, then it's like, you know, just using one of your pairs of eyes. I think you need both eyes in order to focus properly. You need clear thinking, yeah, but you also need depth of vision, which often comes more through the use of symbol and poetry than through clear, you know, just bald, what you might call ratiocination, you know, the use of the rational faculty.
He was kind of a right and left-hand brain man in that way.
Yeah.
Well, we're going to be hearing more from you about the whole area as we get into today's programme, looking at the apologetics of C.S. Lewis, particularly Mere Christianity, perhaps his best-known work. But he wrote, if you like, some more, let's say, in-depth or technical books that still have very wide appeal today, including Miracles and The Problem of Pain, things like that. Dan Barker, though, joins us by phone from the States. Dan has been a guest on this programme a couple of times before. Dan, you were formerly a Christian evangelist. Now I would say you are something of an atheist evangelist. Could you just give us, in a nutshell, the story of what led you to abandon your belief in Christianity?
Well, being an atheist evangelist is, I guess it's a compliment if evangelism is good. It just means spreading the good news, the good news that there is no God, no heaven, no hell, no threat of judgment and all that. That our natural world is more than enough to give us a sense of awe or of the sublime or whatever, that we don't need fairy tales to have a full, meaningful life. But yes, I did believe. I dedicated my life to the faith, and it was wonderful. I loved it. All of my Christian experiences were good experiences. I had no real disappointments or bitterness or any of that. I'm still very good friends with many of my former Christian friends. But it was, as I told you on that previous show, the motivation that drove me into the ministry is the same motivation that drove me out, and that is to know the truth and to speak the truth, to not be afraid to speak what was true. I hear the argument from a lot of Christians, well, you could not have really known Jesus or you wouldn't have left him. But I make a case that if I was not a true Christian, nobody is. The Bible says you shall know them by their fruits, and I was sincerely a believer, and I would go back to it. I'm not opposed to any type of truth, whatever it is. I would gladly go back to it if it were true. My defection, if you will, was intellectual and emotional. It was both sides. Our group also works to promote and educate about the views of non-theists. I guess it is something of an evangelist.
Yeah, I mean, in many ways, your story kind of is the mirror, if you like, of Lewis's, in as much as you went from Christian faith to atheism. Lewis's story is often sort of seen as a classic story, Michael, of atheist becomes Christian. Some people claim, though, that I'm not sure Lewis really was as much an atheist as is sometimes painted to be. I mean, perhaps the classic place where he tells the story is his biography, Surprised by Joy. And this is a line oft quoted by fans of C.S. Lewis, where he has that moment where he realises he has to capitulate, if you like. He says, "You must picture me alone in that room in Magdalen, night after night, feeling whenever my mind lifted even for a second from my work, the steady, unrelenting approach of him who I so earnestly desired not to meet, that which I greatly feared had at last come upon me. In the Trinity term of 1929, I gave in and admitted that God was God and knelt and prayed, perhaps that night, the most dejected and reluctant convert in all England." It sounds like Lewis kind of, at some level, it was reason that drew him to the Christian faith, because he found his intellectual atheism didn't support the world as he actually encountered it. I mean, do you want to give a bit of flesh to what we take from Lewis's conversion story? You know, was he, if you like, an out-and-out atheist? Was he someone who was just not convinced by the God story? I don't know.
Well, he certainly described himself as an atheist. Presumably he knew better than anybody what the real state of his belief was. I don't think it was just a pose. If you look at some of his letters and his diary entries from those years, he clearly seems to have no belief in God or Christ. That passage you just read from Surprised by Joy is not actually about his conversion to Christianity. It's about his conversion to theism, to a belief in God. And I think it probably is fair to say that he reasoned himself to a belief in God, but what led him to a belief in Christ was more than just reason. I think it was other things as well. One of which is the fact that after he became a believer in God, he said that he tried and failed for a whole year to obey his own conscience. He really tried to live what he regarded as a good, upright, moral life. And he said that he failed completely. He couldn't live up to his own standards, let alone those of this God figure out there that he rationally believed in. So it was that kind of moral failure, I suppose, that drove Lewis all the way into the arms of Christian belief, because he felt that it was only through Christ, only through the Holy Spirit, you know, infusing his life, informing his moral actions, that he would actually have the strength, the capacity to lead a good life. He couldn't do it on his own.
It sounds a bit like what St. Paul might have talked about, you know, that we recognise the law, but we recognise that we're incapable of keeping the law. And in that sense, Christ is, if you like, the key to...
That's right. It's a very Pauline thing that he's talking about there, that, you know, the law comes and brings death with it. The law awoke and I died, is how Paul puts it. And the law is good. One of the things that is good about the law is that it shows us our incapacity to be good.
I mean, surprised, I should say, Mere Christianity, his most popular, if you like, apologetics book, which was based, of course, on these radio talks he gave in the war era. A lot of it does dwell on the moral argument for God. This is something particularly, I think, that we've covered actually not long ago on the programme, so I don't want to spend too long on it. But it's something that when you came to reread Mere Christianity yourself, Dan, you felt was an unjust in the way that Lewis sort of presented it. Do you want to sort of tell us what the experience was like coming back to C.S. Lewis as an atheist and how you interacted with the book when you did that?
Well, yes, as a Christian, I read C.S. Lewis, but I didn't need to. You know, it was not like I was searching for God, or I was already a strong believer, and I read C.S. Lewis through the eyes of a Christian. And I admired his writing, and I still do. He's very adept with analogies and with teaching. He's obviously a good teacher, and I wish I could write like that. And I don't admire his logic, though. I don't think he really reasoned that much. I think, from what I read of his conversion of experience, it was more of a sense of the sublime, the numinous, the emotional, something inside of him. And you hear a lot of people talk like that. Many other apologists, like William Lane Craig, talks about his personal experience with the Holy Spirit. So, you know, how do you argue with that? You don't need reason to argue with something like that. But as I read through it, I saw that what C.S. Lewis was doing was, and he admits it, that he was simplifying. He admits it in the opening of many of his books, that he's trying to not be too philosophical. He wants to write to a broader audience. As I read it again, I realized that, you know, science has come a long way since he lived and thought, and especially with the question of morality and this so-called natural law. He dismisses the instincts, for example. There is, in fact, a naturalistic explanation for what you might perceive to be this transcendent natural law within all of us.
I mean, if I can just give a brief idea of how Lewis outlined it. Again, it's just a small quote from Mere Christianity, but perhaps, you know, this is one of the classic lines from it, where Lewis says, "My argument against God was that the universe seemed so cruel and unjust. But how had I got this idea of just and unjust? A man does not call a line crooked unless he has some idea of a straight line. What was I comparing this universe with when I called it unjust?" We'll come back to you in a moment, Dan. I mean, for you, is this a kind of compelling argument when you came across this yourself, Michael, for this concept that there seems to be a standard of what is right and wrong, just and unjust? These concepts must be grounded in something other than just ourselves. Otherwise, there is no ultimate standard by which we can say that we have got it right or wrong.
Well, I think it is quite compelling. I mean, if this universe has just arisen by chance, by random accident, by some undesigned explosion millions of years ago that has, you know, through a succession of random mutations led us to this current position, then why should we be indignant at the cruelty and the wastefulness that we see in so much of nature? I mean, why would we think that way? And why would we assume that there's any kind of impersonal and objective root to our indignation? Why would we say that that indignation is actually right rather than just something we happen to feel, if the universe really was like that? So Lewis's point is that, you know, that our sense of outrage at the crookedness of the universe can only make sense if there is some kind of transcendent and supernatural standard of rightness to which we can dimly grope our way towards, which, you know, you could describe as God if you wished, or a divine spirit behind. You don't have to get to Christianity on this basis, but you can at least maybe get as far as theism. And, you know, there are certain philosophers like Anthony Flew, for instance, a notable atheist who's recently decided that, yeah, a theistic explanation of our situation is better than an atheistic one, because atheism doesn't account for our ability to describe our indignation as right and correct.
What's your response, Dan?
Well, a couple of things. It's totally backwards. Looking at life from the evolutionary framework, which is the only way we can look at how we got where we are, and I'm pretty certain that Michael does not reject the fact of evolution.
That's right, I don't.
Those individuals of us who did not have a sense of injustice and crying out against the threats to our survival, raging against the dangers, would not have survived. Those of us who survived are the ones who did, in fact, care enough about our survival to fear those things that threatened our survival. So we have inbred within us, because of the choices of our ancestors who did survive, that very natural, very sensible distaste or taboo or fear of that which threatens us. And by the way, Anthony Flew is not a theist. He, at most, you would call him a deist, and he did not use the moral argument for his supposed allowance. He didn't convert to theism. His allowance for the possibility of a deistic creator. He doesn't believe in miracles or Christianity or the Bible. And his basic argument was the fine-tuning of the initial constants. But in any event, you can look at the same set of facts as if they're, you know, from one end or the other. And if you already assume that there's a transcendent realm, well, then that makes a nice context within which to place this whole idea of justice and injustice. We know that instinctively, and even Thomas Jefferson pointed this out. He said, you know, if morality is based on this transcendent world, then how do you explain the morality of the atheist? And he listed many good people who were atheistic, who did not believe in a God, who led wonderful, productive, full, meaningful lives without this belief. So I guess it's just a matter of your presuppositions. If you presuppose there's something transcendent, or even if you don't presuppose it, but you've heard it from your culture, and then you have this quote-unquote numinous experience, which happens to a lot of human beings, it's the mystical or the whatever, like C.S. Lewis, well, then you're going to make this irrational jump. I don't think C.S. Lewis's conversion was rational, from what little I know. I think it was a getting in touch with this presence within his mind, this feeling of love, and he talks about that a lot in his books, the numinous, the joy, that he says it's, the love of a man and a woman is just like milk and water compared to this real love of this inner experience. What was happening in him was an internal mental experience.
Okay. Well,
I think totally unrelated to any of these supposed, which we now know are discredited arguments for the existence of a God.
Well, they're arguments which are still under discussion. I wouldn't say they've necessarily been discredited, but I mean, we did, in any case, cover this at quite a deep level 2 weeks ago on the program, the argument from morality with two excellent debaters with me then. I suppose the point is, at some level, though, Michael, Lewis recognised that he couldn't account for his own wish for the way the world is, or the way he found the world. He could only account for that if there was, if you like, a presence underlying it, which kind of gave the foundation for moral beliefs and for and even for reason itself.
Yes, well, yeah, let's maybe talk a little bit more about his understanding of reason itself, that he thought that one couldn't really defend the idea of reason on atheistical principles, because, again, if all that there is in this universe at a fundamental level is the clashing of atoms, you know, admittedly very sophisticated arrangements of atoms in the case of human beings, but if that is fundamentally the nature of our being, then how is it that we would wish to ascribe this metaphysical thing called truth to the ideas that we have in our brains?
I mean, this is something he develops, and this was a big thing for me when I read, sort of as in my late teens, his book Miracles, which is somewhat misleading in its title because half of it is about miracles and the miracles you see Jesus doing, but the other half is actually a kind of quite a detailed sort of framework for this argument for God from reason.
Yeah. It's because he regards rational thought as a miracle of a sort, that in every rational, reasonable human thinker, you have this mini miracle of rationality, that it's not just cerebral biochemistry, it's not just the movement of the grey matter in our brains when our minds are thinking truly, it's actually what he calls a participation in a cosmic spirit of rationality, a cosmic logos that he describes.
I mean, can I just read another small quote from Miracles, which kind of, I think, sums up in a sense where he was coming from on this. He says, "If naturalism is true, we have no reason to trust our conviction that nature is uniform. It can only be trusted if quite a different metaphysic is true, if the deepest thing in reality, the fact which is the source of all other facthood, is a thing in some degree like ourselves, if it is a rational spirit, and we derived our rational spirituality from it, then indeed our conviction can be trusted." I mean, it's an argument that's been developed since he proposed it by people like Alvin Plantinga, and we're going to be having him on the show in a couple of weeks' time as well, talking about the kind of defeater of naturalism as far as he sees it in evolution, which is how, if evolution is the way by which we suppose we've come to have rational faculties, well, what sort of, on what basis do we say we are therefore, we can trust our rational faculties in what is essentially a blind, purposeless kind of process? Only if there is a God who, if you like, grants a basis on which we can trust our rational faculties, can we even start to talk about, you know, that we've got this right.
That's right. Yeah. Can we even begin to talk about the insights of science? And Dan was just talking about the developments in science over the last 50 years, but why is it that we should even trust science if we can't trust our own minds to give us insight into reality? And how could our minds give us insights into reality if they were just, you know, just physical entities? That's one of Lewis's main points in Miracles, that rational thought is of a different order from our other bodily functions. It's qualitatively different from, say, a cough or a sneeze or our other bodily secretions. We actually think of our mental capacities, our insights into reality, as giving us this thing called truth. We are related to things truthfully or falsely. We're not just related to them spatially.
So again, it's a kind of a metaphysical concept which is crying out for an explanation of some kind, which a purely naturalistic, materialist universe doesn't seem to give. Dan, you've been listening to this. What's your initial response to this so-called argument from reason for God?
Yeah, the naturalistic, materialistic worldview does give a very satisfactory explanation for reason. Reason and thought are not qualitatively different from the functioning of any other organ. They are quantitatively different. They are at a more complex level, but there's nothing in the human brain that is qualitatively different from the molecules within the stomach that causes digestion to happen, another organ which is functioning in a certain way for our survival. Truth is not a thing. Michael talks about truth as if it were something that we perceive or find, as if it were a thing. Truth is simply a label for those statements or propositions that we might make that either correspond or don't correspond to reality as we see it. No scientist takes the uniformity of nature as somehow a you know, unbreakable law. It's possible. Every scientist is open to miracles. Every scientist is open to the possibility that we simply haven't waited long enough to know. But in the meantime, we have no choice but to assume that since the world is uniform today and is working according to these, we use the word law, and that word law is very ambiguous because it sometimes can assume a lawgiver. But in science, that's not what a law is. There's a difference between descriptive laws and prescriptive laws. But in science, a law is a rule that over many, many observations, we expect and predict that those observations will continue. We don't say they have to, but it's a rule that is in place that has served us very well. Science is not a dogma or a creed. So C.S. Lewis has fallen into this trap, and it's not just theists who make this trap, but this trap of somehow, he's a dualist, basically. He thinks mind is somehow qualitatively different from the natural world, when in fact we can show through science the beauty. In fact, I think it's even more awe-inspiring than some super being up there with desires and wants and petty grievances who created us for his own loneliness or whatever it was. We can see how, from simplicity, complexity can arise, not the other way around. The theistic answer assumes that complexity arises from more complexity, which answers nothing, because what is God made of? Isn't God made of some kind of spiritual atoms that are bouncing around inside of him, too? Doesn't God have some standard of right and wrong for his own mind? Isn't this God supposed, you know, what is his sense of the numinous and the sublime? This is all backwards.
Okay, you know, we're going to have to take a quick break, I'm afraid, Dan, and we'll have Michael respond to those points in just a moment's time. We will get on as well if you're listening and you're thinking of other aspects of C.S. Lewis's writing. I'd like us to look at maybe that classic trilemma and what we make of that in Mere Christianity. Jesus is either a liar, lunatic, or Lord. Often sort of comes up in conversation. What do we make of that particular apologetic argument for the deity of Christ? But we'll also get your response as well, Michael, in a moment to this whole issue that Dan's saying, you know, well, surely if science tells us anything, it tells us that we are just a very complicated brain, and we don't have to ascribe an immaterial soul or anything else to us. So we'll come to that in a moment's time. You're listening to Unbelievable as we look at the apologetic of C.S. Lewis today on the programme with Michael Ward, who is an authority on C.S. Lewis, chaplain also of St. Peter's College, Oxford, author of Planet Narnia and the soon-to-be-released The Narnia Code. I'll put up some links to those books as well with this podcast at premier.org.uk/unbelievable. We'll be back in just a moment's time.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Well, welcome back as we continue to look at the apologetics of C.S. Lewis, one of the most popular lay apologists probably in the world, and he continues to have a great appeal, especially in America. I mean, I know that you're in great demand, Michael, over in the States. There seems to be a real kind of C.S. Lewis movement around. people who almost, I have to say, almost idolise him in some ways. Do you think that it's healthy, the kind of the amount of reverence that is given to Lewis and his works out in the States?
You're right. He is very much more popular in the States than he is over here. And on the whole, I think it's quite healthy. Yeah, it's partly, just to generalise grossly, it's partly, you know, the American temperament that if they like something, they are unashamed to be enthusiastic about it and to tell you. And, you know, there are lots of reasons, I think, behind the popularity of Lewis in the States.
I suppose the fact that there is such a large evangelical Christian contingent who obviously the appeal of his apologetics particularly is relevant in that situation. I think people also like the idea of an Oxford Don.
That's
and,
right.
And yeah. all the attraction that that brings with
there,
it.
There's a strong Anglophile element in a lot of American culture. They like things that are British just because they're British. whereas we, the Brits, you know, it's no great shakes for us to be British.
And you must be almost the next best thing to C.S. Lewis, given that you were, I think you sort of looked after the kilns and the sort of the places where Lewis...
I lived in Lewis's house, the kilns, for 3 years as a kind of resident warden, sleeping in his bedroom and studying in his study. And and the Americans, many of the Americans that I interact with, you know, they can hardly conceive that this should be possible.
Did you feel his presence, Michael?
No, I didn't.
But coming back to what we were talking about before we went to a break, I mean, Dan there was kind of saying, no, look, you don't need to go to this extra level of thinking that there's some kind of immaterial sort of aspect to truth, to reason. It is just what our, you know, we're doing the best job we can with science, and the best... As far as we can see, science just tells us we are a brain, a material thing that kind of comes up with the best explanations for the world around us. And that's what we live with. That's what we do. We see, you know, nature has been uniform up till now. And we can, you know, rationally expect it to be uniform in the future. We can expect that the things we consider to be true really are true as best we can. Why do we need anything extra? Why was Lewis so keen to suggest that, you know, we don't have an ultimate foundation in some sense for our reason unless we invoke God?
Well, I think it comes back to this idea of what you consider to be truth. How is it that we trust our minds to give us this insight into reality? I mean, Dan talks about truth being no more than just a correspondence between our minds and reality, but why should we even think that there should be a reliable correspondence if the universe is just, you know, clashings of atoms at the ultimate level? When it comes to true thoughts, Lewis argues, we escape from the simple material naturalistic explanation of cause and effect to a new kind of relationship, which he calls the ground-consequent relationship, that when we understand something truly, it's not just because we have been, you know, shunted in a particular direction by a natural impulse. You know, it's not just like that we've caught some infection which is causing us to sneeze. It's not like we've just been thumped on the shoulder and therefore shifted slightly to the right. It's not a cause and effect in that sense. It's a ground and a consequent. We see grounds for rational belief, and the consequence of that perception is true belief. So an example that Lewis gives is, you know, to just try to clarify what he means between this difference between the ground-consequent relationship and the cause-effect relationship is, you know, you could say grandfather is ill today because he ate lobster last night. That's a cause and effect relationship. But you could also say grandfather has left the house because his hat is not hanging in the hall. And we know that he never goes out of the house without putting on his hat. Now, it's not the absence of his hat from the hat stand hasn't caused his absence from the house, but it is the grounds for our belief in his absence from the house. And that ability to see grounds and consequences is what Lewis calls this rational faculty, this ability to perceive truth.
And for him, that there's a big gap if you don't have, if all we are is, as you say, at an ultimate level, atoms banging into one another, albeit in very complex ways, we still can't get from that to a kind of ultimate trust that this is the way that rationality works, that you know.
Yes, it really is qualitatively different. It's mysterious. You know, it is hard to account for on naturalistic grounds, this ability to perceive truth. And scientists, I think, they slightly pretend that they don't believe in truth when really I think they do. And they get very cross with people who want to dispute the findings of science, because scientists believe that they have made correct deductions from their experiments and from their observations. And they call that truth. I mean, it might not be ultimate truth. There might be more to discover. And I'm very pleased to hear Dan say that no scientist disbelieves in the possibility of miracles. That's news to me. But scientists believe that what they've discovered is true.
We are going to move the conversation on now, gentlemen. I hate to sort of have to kind of draw a veil in that way, because I would like to get to kind of, if you like, the more Christological aspect of C.S. Lewis's apologetic. Maybe briefly, Michael, you could lay out what is sometimes called Lewis's trilemma. Then we'll have Dan respond, and then you sort of pick up what Dan has
well,
to say.
Well, in Mere Christianity, Lewis develops this argument that Jesus Christ was either a liar, a lunatic, or the Lord of all creation. Lord, lunatic, or liar. That's the trilemma. And he comes to that position because he says that a man who said and did the things that Jesus said and did, you know, claiming to be divine, claiming the ability to forgive sins, not only sins committed against him, but sins committed against other people, that behavior of Jesus of Nazareth, on any other explanation than that he was who he said he was, namely one with the Father, could only be accounted for on the basis that he was, you know, just sheerly lying. He was deceiving people when he said it, or else that he was mad. He was he was deluded about reality to such an extent that we shouldn't trust his claim to be divine. And you know, it's a relatively simple trilemma that he presents.
I think you see a sort of a form of it even in one of the Narnia stories, in the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, when the children come to the professor saying, "Oh, Lucy's been telling us this strange story about going into a wardrobe and meeting a faun." Mm. And the professor, rather than dismissing the story as they expected him to, says to them, "Well, is she given to lying? Mm. Do you think she's mad?" And they say, No. Then perhaps the third possibility is true, that she's telling the truth. I'll read out briefly as well a segment of what he writes in Mere Christianity itself on this. He says, "I'm trying here to prevent anyone saying the really foolish thing that people often say about him. I'm ready to accept Jesus as a great moral teacher, but I don't accept his claim to be God. That is the one thing we must not say. A man who was merely a man and said the sort of things Jesus said would not be a great moral teacher. He would either be a lunatic, on the level with a man who says he is a poached egg, or else he would be the devil of hell. You must make your choice. Either this man was and is the Son of God, or else a madman, or something worse. You can shut him up for a fool, you can spit at him and kill him as a demon, or you can fall at his feet and call him Lord and God. But let us not come with any patronising nonsense about his being a great human teacher." Now, the trilemma has been something that has been obviously discussed at some in some detail. Dan, what's your initial reaction to the trilemma that Lewis first proposed in Mere Christianity?
Well, one thing C.S. Lewis was not was a student of the Bible in any great depth. He read the Bible, but his understanding, from what I read, was quite simplistic. The trilemma is a false trilemma. There are more than those three options. There are at least two other options, and one of them is another capital L word, which many biblical scholars, and in fact many Christian scholars, put into the mix, and that is legend. Jesus may not have even said those things. His followers, the people who wrote the Bible, the people who put it together, could have created this person or created the words in the mouth of this person in retrospect, going back through history. So liar, lunatic, or Lord are not the only options. In fact, in my book, Godless and in Losing Faith and Faith, I make a strong case for the legend framework for understanding the writings in the New Testament. Maybe Jesus did exist and said a few things, but if you do what Thomas Jefferson did and strip out the legendary from the historical, we see that many of those things that we might think were lunatic or lying were actually just words put in his mouth. But there's another option besides those four, and that is he might have been mistaken. He might have actually thought he was telling the truth. He might have not been lunatic at all. He might have thought that there's all of these signs were, you know, like my Christians today are mistaken. Michael is mistaken in his belief that there actually is a God and a devil and a heaven and a hell. I wouldn't call Michael a liar. I wouldn't call him a lunatic. I would just say that he has misinterpreted or fallen into accepting the interpretations of other people. So there are many other options for looking at this supposed great trilemma than just liar, lunatic, or lord.
Thank you very much, Dan. I'm sure you've come across that yourself, Michael. I mean, any response there? I guess Lewis never, you know, made himself out to be a biblical critical scholar in that sense. Does the argument, the trilemma, fall down because, you know, what Dan says, well, what if it was just legendary, the sayings attributed to Jesus, etc.?
Yeah, Dan's right. Lewis wasn't a biblical scholar. But I think one needs to understand the context of this mere Christianity argument. It was in the context of a 15-minute broadcast pitched at a very popular level to a very unscholarly audience. And so Lewis wasn't going to get into questions of biblical criticism, which he did know a fair bit about, even if he wasn't a professional biblical scholar. He wasn't going to get into, you know, redaction criticism and form criticism and all these schools of biblical criticism that biblical scholars deploy in order to, you know, to try to test out the veracity of the scriptures. Lewis is basing his argument on the assumption that the biblical records are basically reliable. Mm. And he's not going to go into it any more deeply than that. But of course, yeah, I mean, he would recognize that, you know, logically speaking, there is this this option of the legend. But he's assuming that that's already been discounted. And, you know, he's saying, if Jesus said and did the things that he's recorded as saying and doing, then we have this situation ahead of us. And to deal with what Dan says about the possibility that Jesus was just mistaken, well, I think that here we're slightly splitting hairs, that there's a degree of mistakenness which most of us would ordinarily call madness, lunacy. You know, people are so mistaken about the nature of themselves and their place in the universe that we actually call them unhinged, lunatic.
So essentially, if someone came down the road and told me, I'm the Son of God, anyone who's seen me has seen the Father, you know, you'd have to say they're a little bit more than just mistaken.
Yeah.
They happen to have come to the wrong conclusion.
Most
people would say, no, you're mad, mate.
Yeah, this is a particularly gross mistake, if mistake it is, yeah. And a mistake which is of such an order that I think it's not unfair to call it madness. If you're claiming to be one with the power that made the universe, I mean, that's a different order of mistake from my mistake, if mistake it is, as Dan believes it to be, that God created this universe and Christ died for our sins.
I mean, unfortunately, we don't have the time, again, to go into an in-depth, you know, textual, historical sort of look at the sayings of Jesus about himself and whether, you know, we can, you know, say that they are there. But there are plenty of programmes, and I would encourage you to look at them, particularly perhaps the one from about a year ago with Richard Borkham on this very subject on this programme. So I'll post a link as well to that. Lots of links to post from today's programme. But that's a very interesting programme on whether Jesus, the statements Jesus made about himself, whether they can be historically seen as you know, authentic, as it were, about his messiahship, etc. That was Richard Borkham with James Crossley, I think. That episode of Unbelievable, I'll post up with this. I mean, but for me, what it comes down to is kind of what he starts that quotation from Mere Christianity with, which is what he wants to get to is people who say Jesus was a great moral teacher, because that, he says, is not one of the options. I mean, do you agree with that in a sense, that you can't just have Jesus as the great moral teacher, but even though many people like to talk of Jesus as the great moral teacher?
Well, if Jesus was so mistaken about himself as to think that he was, you know, he existed before Abraham, if he's so mistaken as to think that he's, you know, the ground of everyone's being in some mysterious sense, then it does throw a big question mark over, you know, his teaching when he says, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. Why should we trust the latter if we can't trust the former?
How unique do you think Jesus actually was, Dan, as far as his moral teachings go and the things he said about himself?
Jesus, if he existed, was not a great moral teacher. He did say some good things. I keep talking about Thomas Jefferson a lot, but Thomas Jefferson said he dug through the words of Jesus to try to find some good teachings, and he found some, but he told his friend John Adams that it was like digging through a dunghill to find a diamond. The golden rule is not a bad idea. I would call it maybe a silver or a bronze rule, but it pre-existed in Christianity. Jesus didn't come up with that. He even admitted, he paraphrased it in the same pretty much way that Hillel had in the first century B.C., who was flipping a version that Confucius had even 500 years earlier. So love your enemies and those things. You know, all religions have good teachings in them. Who's opposed to world peace and love and forgiveness and goodness? If you look at all the religions of the world, you can pick out of them these great moral teachings that are really human teachings. They are teachings which confer survival advantage and confer community and so on. And it would be surprising if this Jesus character of the New Testament didn't say a few things like that. But on balance, his teachings were not good moral teaching. He had some horrible teachings in there, not least of which was his promotion of the idea of hell, a lake of fire and burning and torment and judgment. Even the Beatitudes are all predicated upon some other condition, you know, so that you can live long. They're not really true altruistic. He talked about castration. He said there are some men who should castrate themselves, and he that is able to receive it, let him receive it. He talked with glee, maybe metaphorically, about cutting off body parts in a sexual context. He talked about hating your father and your mother. He said, I came not to bring peace, but I came to bring a sword on this earth. So if you look at Jesus through just normal eyes, not the rose-colored glasses of a believing Christian, and pick out all the good things, if you weigh them side by side, he was not an admirable moral teacher. Michael, you or I could have come up with a better system of morality than this Jesus character did.
Yes, well, what Dan just said would please C.S. Lewis a great deal, because Dan isn't coming with any patronizing nonsense about Jesus being a great moral teacher. So that's good as far as Lewis is concerned. You know, Dan isn't falling into the trap of patronizing Jesus and saying, you know, he's great as a moral teacher, and yet we can't trust his statements about his own divinity. So to that extent, Dan and Lewis are on the same page. The question is, you know, if we really find reasons to trust what Jesus says about his authority, well, then the hard sayings, you know, the difficult sayings, we need to treat with a little bit more seriousness and ask ourselves, well, perhaps these hard sayings, which crack like a whip, Lewis says, he's not trying to disguise some of the toughness of Jesus' teaching. Maybe that toughness is the kind of toughness that we need. And given the moral decrepitude that we see both in our own hearts and in the world around us, you know, there's something pretty seriously wrong with this world. You know, maybe the remedy is going to be pretty hard too.
I mean, I suppose many people hearing Dan talking about some of those phrases, you know, I come not to bring peace but to bring a sword, you know, they would say, well, you've got to look at the context, you've got to look at sort of what Jesus was actually saying. He wasn't saying, you know, literally take up a sword and go and get your mum and dad or anything like that. He was saying choosing me may mean choosing may put you against other people, you know. I mean, is Dan being fair to the text here, or is this just you and me, Michael, as Christians, saying, no, you've got to look at it our way and not your way?
Well, I think many of those sayings that Dan just listed are typically hyperbolic ways, you know, familiar to a Jewish audience, hyperbolic ways of teaching. You overstate your case in order to make your point. You know, you make it inescapably clear the point you want to make. But that's not to say that, you know, that you must therefore hate your mother and father. He's just saying that if push comes to shove and you have to choose between doing what your dad says and doing what God says, then you have to set your face toward God and set your face against what you've been conditioned by your society to believe. But that's just hyperbole.
I mean, what's interesting as well is Dan suggests that, you know, Jesus was in no way unique in that sense. But in a way, neither did Lewis argue that Jesus was in that sense unique. He spoke of there being many expressions, in a sense, of God, but that Jesus was in some sense the true expression, the fulfillment.
That's a good point, yeah. I mean, I think it's in his book, The Problem of Pain, he says that actually there's not that much in Jesus' teaching, which you can't find in other great teachers. The really peculiar thing, the unique thing about Jesus is not so much his teaching as it is his person and his office, who he was, who he is, rather than what he said and what he taught.
I mean, perhaps, you know, it would be interesting just, again, this is from Mere Christianity, and Lewis talking about other religions. I'd like to see how you respond to this, Dan, at this point. Lewis says, and again, remember, this is a kind of transcript from those original radio interviews. He says, "I've been asked to tell you what Christians believe, and I'm going to begin by telling you one thing that Christians do not need to believe. If you're a Christian, you do not have to believe that all the other religions are simply wrong all through. If you're an atheist, you do have to believe that the main point in all the religions of the whole world is simply one huge mistake. If you're a Christian, you are free to think that all these religions, even the queerest ones, I suppose we'd say strangest these days, contain at least some hint of the truth. When I was an atheist, I had to try to persuade myself that most of the human race have always been wrong about the question that mattered to them most. When I became a Christian, I was able to take a more liberal view." It's sort of it's a red flag to stir people, I suppose, that kind of view that actually it's we Christians who are the more liberal ones compared to you atheists. But what do you make of that particular sort of way of viewing truth claims about religions, Dan?
Yeah, well, he was wrong about atheism. Atheists, at least the atheists that I am and the atheists that I know, do accept the truth value of most religions. In other words, the good humanistic moral teachings that are embedded within, and I would say transcend all religions because they're human values. They're not religious values, peace and love and giving and sharing and all those things. Atheists want those things and embrace those things, and we see that in all these different conflicting religions that fight with each other and kill each other and have their gods by different names, we see that they're all really striving for the same humanistic thing, and that is a world with less violence, a world with more understanding, a world with more peace in it. So Lewis is wrong to mischaracterize atheists. I don't know what kind of an atheist he was. And maybe he was being hyperbolic himself. And by the way, if Jesus was being hyperbolic in many of his statements, then where do you draw the line? Is heaven a hyperbole? Is hell a hyperbole? Is even God a hyperbole then? Is all of this just one huge figure of speech? You know, I mean, either you take it at face value where you must, or you don't. And if there's just metaphor and hyperbole and exaggeration, and by the way, and an exaggeration and a hyperbole is a form of untruth, except where it's made clear, for example, that he's teaching a parable. Well, we don't fault him for telling an untruth because we don't, you know, we know that a parable is a metaphor. So I think the point C.S. Lewis is trying to make can be turned around and say, look, we're all the same human beings. We all have the same human nature, basically, if you're mentally healthy. And we all want the same things. And religion is one sort of, you might say, premature or early attempt at our species to try to put it all together. And let's give it credit where credit is due, you know.
But essentially, we've outgrown it. We don't have to have that gloss, if you like. What you were actually all aiming for, all your religions, was actually my humanistic, atheistic sort of framework, which will do just fine without the addition of
it. All of us.
Right, sure. We're going to have to, again, take a quick break, and we'll then be into our final section, and I'll just get Michael to respond to some of that, some of what you said there, Dan. But you're listening to a programme looking at some of the various ways in which C.S. Lewis, if you like, defended the Christian faith, defended the rationality of God in his apologetics.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
So we're concluding now on the apologetics of C.S. Lewis. I have to say I was very influenced by Lewis as a young Christian, and I'm sure it played a part in your own journey as well, Michael. Michael Ward, by the way, is one of the foremost authorities on Lewis, and if you haven't got it yet, I do urge you to go out and get his book. There's the big one that you can hit someone over the head with called Planet Narnia, and there's the more slimline version, which is the Narnia Code, and I'm going to put links to both those up with the programme today. But that's a fascinating look at the hidden code that Lewis put within the Narnia stories. But Michael, you've come in more to talk about apologetics today and in conversation with our atheist guest Dan Barker on the phone from the States. You know, Dan says, okay, you can have your, you know, moral religion, but at the end of the day, all religions are just essentially coming out with what we all agree on between the religions is what rational, humanistic kind of, you know, morality will bring you to anyway. Why do you need God in the picture? what in a sense for Lewis was the importance of having God then, you know, rather than just going along with the sort of, I think maybe you touched on it at the beginning, that it was possibly about the fact that he found he couldn't actually keep these humanistic moral principles without reference to God. I don't know.
Well, yeah, I think that is part of it, that he felt that he couldn't be good even by his own standards in his own power. So yes, he needed something other and outer in order to assist him in his desire to be good. And, you know, in saying that, he's not saying that non-believers or believers in other religions can't be good in any sense. What he's saying is that he can't be good. I think it would be fair to say that he knows no other better way of being good than of trusting in Christ and receiving the support of his Holy Spirit through prayer, through obedience, through fellowship, through communion, through baptism, through Bible reading, and all the other ways in which Christians believe that they receive divine aid. That, for Lewis, was the best way that he knew in which he could lead a good, happy, beautiful, true life. And naturally, he wanted to share what he had discovered.
Dan, in a way, I'm sure you're not going to knock anyone who you know, does good things, whether or not you believe it's on some kind of irrational basis, perhaps. I mean, is there any reason why, you know, as we've said, an evangelist almost for atheism, you feel that, you know, Lewis was actually doing wrong by promoting the Christian message? Is believing in something that has good consequences but on a false basis for you as bad as, you know, wrong yeah. consequences? I don't know.
Well, on the one hand, we would all rather have people act good than not. And if they need an excuse, if alcoholics need some higher power to hang on to, just to be sober, well, we'd rather have them sober than not. Although there are many alcoholics who do it without a higher power, they do it with reason. So in that sense, we all believe, in, you know, Christians and atheists alike, that people should be judged by their actions, not their belief. I don't care if a believer wants to stand on their head and pray to Mother Goose and speak in tongues and roll on the floor. I don't care. That's their own personal business. And if C.S. Lewis had his own personal hang-ups or problems with how he needed some framework for being good in his life, well, then he found his way to solve it, which coincidentally kind of coincided with the cultural religion that he was raised with surrounding him. So I would rather C.S. Lewis had been a good guy than a total jerk. And in a sense, it's kind of, Lewis is sort of confessing a sort of inbred pessimism of human nature. He's sort of saying, hey, we're lousy, we're not good, we're bad. Well, speak for yourself. Maybe he did feel that way, and maybe he was eloquent in it, but millions of people on this planet don't feel that way. Maybe it's a bell curve distribution of some, I don't know, view of human nature. Many of us are optimistic, or at least not pessimistic, about human nature, and we do think we can use reason and kindness and a basic evolved sense of altruism and empathy and morality and goodness and the attempt to minimize harm and enhance well-being in the planet without some external prop to do it. And so I kind of feel sorry for Lewis that he thinks he needs that, and for many people, and maybe I don't know what Michael thinks, but he probably feels the same way, that he doesn't think he's capable, although he does think he's capable of judging the Scripture. He does think he's capable of judging these arguments on the one hand, but incapable of judging whether or not he wants to be a good person. What I would say, basically, is if you want to be a good person, then be a good person. What's so hard about that? It's no big mystery. Live in a way that decreases harm in the world.
Thank you for joining us on the program today, Dan. Do you want to respond to Dan and give your own sort of summing up of where you feel we've got to in the program today, Michael?
Before that is. Yeah, golly, there's a lot to think about there, isn't there? Well, I don't think that, you know, I'm qualified to judge the scriptures, but I'm not qualified to be a good person. I think I'm qualified to do precisely nothing on my own merits or my own intelligence. You know, that unsupported by my Maker, by my Redeemer, is, as far as I'm concerned, nothing. It's all just a lot of nonsense, unrelated to my final end. So, you know, if Christ has not been raised from the dead, then I am of all men most to be pitied, because I am staking my whole life, my thinking, my acting, my doing on this premise, and I'm prepared to see where the chips fall on that. But at the moment, I believe from inside this experience that it's a good way to go. And I'm pleased that Dan, in his experience, is finding his way a good way for him. I hope it remains good for him. But I've found that when I've tried to live on those principles, that it soon runs into the sand, or it runs into the sand eventually. And then one comes to the end of one's own resources, and one does need to have some outside help, and one asks for it in an unashamed fashion. There's nothing shameful about a cripple using a pair of what do you call those, crutches?
Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, in that sense, C.S. Lewis, the fact that we're still talking about him on a show, you know, in 2010, just shows the influence he's had that endures. As I say, I wish he was still alive. I wish he could be here in the studio with us. And in some ways, many people try to almost keep that memory alive in almost that way. But what do we need another C.S. Lewis, do you think, Michael? I don't know. It occurs to me that many people sort of, we have some great Christian apologists, as it were, but we don't really quite have anyone like C.S. Lewis anymore, do we? Because C.S. Lewis was much more than just an apologist.
Yeah, he was an unusually widely talented man, because he had his professional skills as a literary historian. Then he had great imaginative gifts as a writer of fiction and poetry. But then these argumentative, rational, and apologetic gifts, which we've been talking about today. And there's no one on the current scene who seems to have all those three going for them at once. I mean, there are some very significant and able people, and you've had some of them on this programme, I'm sure. People like Alistair McGrath and Tom Wright and other notable presenters of faith. People like Tim Keller in the States. He's doing some good work, I think. So,
And quotes constantly from C.S. Lewis.
Yeah, he does. Yeah. But, you know, it's horses for courses, and yeah. God does not leave himself without a witness in any generation.
Well, thank you for joining me on the programme today. If you want to get hold of Michael's work, as I say, do look on the Unbelievable webpage, and I'm going to post up links to his books, both Planet Narnia, which is kind of the bigger volume on this special code he's found in the Narnia stories, and the Narnia Code, which is again quite wide-ranging, but is also worth picking up as well. Go to premier.org.uk/unbelievable and find out more there. In the meantime, thanks to both my guests for joining me on the programme today, Dan Barker as well. I'll post up details of where you can find him at the Freedom From Religion Foundation in the States. Well, thank you for listening to this week's Classic Replay. Hope you enjoyed it, and you can find links to our newsletter, YouTube channel, ways to give, and the archive of past shows at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable.